Welcome back to another episode of the Brawn Body Health and Fitness Podcast. Joining me today is Dr. Mackenzie Yab. Mackenzie is a sports physical therapy resident at UPMC, and she works with local high school and college teams in the area, providing sports physical therapy services. And she's also working with a good friend of mine, Keelan Inseki, who is also a past podcast guest. Mackenzie and I are going to be discussing vascular injury in athletes. So what to look for, how to progress, how to proceed accordingly, return to run considerations, and so much more. Very often overlooked area in the athletic population. A lot of times clinicians seem to forget about the neurovascular structures. And I think this is a great episode to kind of bring some of that back to the forefront. This episode and every episode in season 5 is sponsored by ISOFIT, my go-to for everything relating to isometric strength training. For more on ISOFIT, you can check the description below. Enjoy. Mackenzie, welcome to the podcast. I'm super excited to work with you today. Thank you so much for being here and for your time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
For people who might not be familiar with you or all the amazing things that you're doing there out in Pittsburgh, would you mind filling them in a little bit about who you are and all that you do?
Yeah. So right now I am currently doing my sports residency at UPMC Sports Med. I do a lot of different roles for them. But right now I'm working at a local high school. I do PT services for them, as well as working in our sports medicine clinic, down at Rooney. And then I also am going to transition to the college basketball team at Pitt, here shortly, and work with them as well. Another part of my residency is I teach at Pitt as a teaching assistant and stuff of that nature. So a lot of different opportunities thrown at me, and I'm really enjoying it. Only been here for, I guess we were just saying like 8 months. So still kind of learning Pittsburgh, but came from Boston before that, went to school there at Boston University, go Terriers. and then originally from Michigan. So been traveling around a bit the last few years, and it's been fun. So.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And huge shout out to our boy Keelan there
for doing
such a great job out there in Pittsburgh. Really love what you guys are doing. And, you know, recently I was kind of told a little bit about some work you did relating to a vascular injury in the lower extremity in the athletic population. And I think that's something, at least for myself, I don't see a whole lot of them. Or, you know, when an athlete comes to see me with like pain or really any kind of symptoms in the lower half of their body, like, to me, like, vasculature is not the first thing to jump into my head. In fact, I'd probably go out on a limb and say majority of the time I'm not really assessing vascular function, which maybe I should be. But it's just interesting to me because that's something that I feel like we often forget about and miss in clinical practice.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that's why it was of interest to me. I had, you know, a specific case that I was looking at when I did this for my grand rounds for part of my residency, where he actually, my patient had a known blood clot in the extremity previously before seeing me. And I think what I found originally was it was a bit of a shock to the system when you read something like that in a medical chart and you're like, okay, now I have to treat this patient. And then you kind of don't really know where to go, right? I think that's where my issue was and why I kind of got looking into that and everything. And then I kind of started asking around to other, I work with a lot of great PTs, and was asking like, hey, have you dealt with this in an athletic population as well? Like, and you know, they're few and far in between, but it does happen. There's a reason we educate people on DVT risk. And I think we just don't necessarily think about that with our athletes and younger patients, even though it can happen as much to them as it can to, you know, somebody who's 55 and had a total knee or something of that nature. So I think that's why it was super interesting to me. And just a little bit of a personal note, because he was my patient, right? And I didn't want to mess anything up. I wanted to be careful and make sure we did what we needed to do to get him back to his function, but also do it safely. And I definitely, it was a shock. It was a shock to figure that out as a new grad coming out of school and not, you know the what you're supposed to be looking for, but do you ever really know when it's like right in front of you? Probably not. So it's an interesting case for sure. I don't know if you've had experiences at all in your practice. I know you said you work with a lot of ACLs, people having symptoms and stuff of that nature.
I was going to say, you bring up so many amazing points here. I mean, first off, the fact that this can happen in the younger population. You know, I still remember going over like some of those different things in school, like your Wells criteria and that sort of thing. And I was like, oh, great. You know, I'll work with athletes afterwards and then I'll never need this. And exactly. It's like, oh, shoot, I actually need this all the time. Because you see a lot of post-op knees and you look through those Wells criteria and it's like, hey, you know, they did just have a major surgery, you know, ACL, meniscus, surgeon might have been in there for a little bit over an hour, sometimes 2 hours, depending on how much work was done. And it's like, you know, that's a risk factor. Hey, they're not moving as much right now. That's a risk factor. On top of that, too, I completely underestimated the importance of like the travel considerations, right? Like there's a lot of documented cases, even in the military population, which you would think if anyone doesn't sit still, it's the military population. But, you know, some of these longer distance travel type things that they have to do, you know, they sometimes develop things. Sometimes there's underlying genetic factors that get missed because we don't really genetic test every single person ever for different underlying conditions relating to blood clotting. So I certainly think this can happen. I have seen it happen in someone following an osteotomy procedure of the knee. So I've seen it. I think it can happen. It can definitely happen in the younger athletic population, but it's not the fact that it does happen. It's the fact that we need to be appropriate in how we respond to it. Like, you know, when it does happen, okay, what do we do? And I think that's a place where a lot of people get missed or a lot of people like misunderstand things, right? Like, you know, if I'm seeing these things on exam acutely, like that's an emergency to me. Like, I'm not saying, hey, go home, take it easy. It's like, no, we're going to the ER like right now and we're getting a Doppler. And you know, I hope and pray that that's always a negative thing because I don't want someone to run into these issues. But you know, if they do, I'd rather them catch it because we forget, or at least a lot of us seem to forget that this is like a potentially life-threatening thing for people.
Well, it absolutely is. I mean, I think the connotation we get is, I think, in outpatient orthopedics specifically, we're like, we're just trying to get them back to their function, right? We know they have an injury. I think we very rarely think about like some of the major life consequences we can have, right? I know a few years ago, there was an instance at a clinic where somebody had a PE and dropped and died in the clinic. So like things happen. And I know that's very, you know, that's one in a million probably in that instance, right? And are we really going to stop a PE from happening? Absolutely not. That's, you know, it happens. But if we can like just have a more structured approach to making sure that we are checking all of our boxes, I think it just makes it way more efficient. And I just don't think it's talked about enough. Like how many times we know when ACLs come out, we need to look at like knee extension, quad activation, right? We know those things. Those are pretty structured things, but very rarely do we say, hey, let's do like a neurovascular assessment. Like we should be doing that. Like that should be the first thing we do. And I think it gets lost in everything else. And you know, I think some people do it. I'm not talking to everybody, but I think it's less emphasized than it should be in situations like this, especially if you know you're seeing a lot of post-op patients.
Why do you think it is that we end up skipping it? Is it super time consuming to do these things like chest, like a test, like a tibial artery pulse or like a dorsalis pedis or like,
I mean, it's not time consuming, right? I think it's something we can easily be doing. I personally think it's comfortability. Like, are we comfortable doing these tests? Like you might've done this, what, maybe once or twice in PT school, and then you don't go back to it, right? I think a lot of it, and I'm talking specifically personally for myself too, when I got my specific patient that I was talking about, I was like, whoa, I haven't done like a dorsalis pedis pulse, found one in a while. Like, so I think like in the back of your mind, you're like, eh. Like, I think, is this really what's happening? Probably not, but I need to be checking it either way. And I think the only way we get that ingrained is if we do it more often. Yeah. And I think it's just habit at this point. Like, okay, that's the first thing. You can do it while you're doing your subjective. Like, it's not like it's something that you have to be like totally like on and like you feel the pulse or you don't, right? So I think more of it is maybe we're just not comfortable asking the questions we need to ask or doing kind of the small testing that we need to do. And if that's the answer, it's like, we have a lot of colleagues who have pulses and we can do it on them in practice. And if we need to, but I think personally for me, that's where I think we lack. Could be a variety of reasons too.
Yeah. Well, why not do it on, to your point, it takes almost no time at all. Like exactly. 10, 15 seconds. Why not do it on literally every lower extremity patient that walks in your door? Pre-op, post-op, conservative management, whatever it is, plain and simple. It took me a while to really grasp this concept, but you know, while you learn things like special tests and range of motion measurements and all these things in school, and you know them like the back of your hand, your patient has no idea what you're doing. Mm-hmm. They just know that you're assessing things. They don't know like, oh, that's a Lachman. Oh, that's an anterior drawer and so on that way. So I literally started right after I graduated doing Lachman, pivot shift, and valgus stress testing on every knee I saw, as long as they weren't like, you know, post-op day one or like post-op, you know, first few months, that sort of thing, just because I wanted to get a better appreciation for the feel. You know, yeah. What does a positive one feel like? What does a negative one feel like? What does it feel like in different patients and so on that way? So, you know, getting used to that from a vascular standpoint is also essential. Because again, if you're just kind of poking around in different places, patients have no idea what you're assessing. You can run them through and educate them on everything after the fact. But in the moment, I would much rather get that extra skill and extra rep of, okay, this is how, you know, this is where this person's pulse is, this is how strong it is. Like just establish that normalcy and establish yeah. that kind of refresher skill for yourself, because if you do that on every new patient, you're probably practicing it multiple times per week, hundreds of times per year. I mean, that's just built-in competency right there.
Well, and then when it comes to the point where you might have a situation where you have an abnormal finding, you're way more confident in what you're doing. And you can be more confident, because I think that's another part of this and just another avenue that will probably go down at some point, is just the confidence of being like, oh yeah, that's a concerning symptom, go to the emergency room, like, and making that definitive call. But I think if you're confident with your assessment, you can be confident in that as well. And I also think that's why we tend to be a little maybe wishy-washy on like, oh, I don't know, that's concerning, but that's not. And we kind of go back and forth. I think if you know you're confident in your neurovascular assessment, you're going to be confident in the call you make and in what you're telling the patient too.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you mentioned it yourself earlier as well here, Mackenzie, right? Like if you weren't sure about something, you tapped out and asked a colleague, right? Like this is not an ego-driven thing. It's not a, I have to do this all myself and make every decision. Like there's Absolutely. Literally nothing bad that's going to come from saying, hey, look, I just want someone else to assess this real quick and see what they think. You walk over, you snag someone else, they look at it, you know, 30 seconds later, you can compare notes, talk about it, that sort of thing, right? Like teamwork makes the dream work. I know it's cliche, but it's like, if you're not sure, there is literally no shame at all in asking for a second opinion from someone who's literally like 10 feet away from you and works at the same job in the same clinic as you.
And I would argue, even if you are 100% sure, right? We kind of talked about the stakes in this situation. It's high. Like this can be life-threatening. It could be limb-threatening too. So why not, if you have any concern at all, why not just come get it checked? Even if it's just for your peace of mind. Like, so you can be like, yep, I think this, you have a colleague walk over. They basically give you, yeah, I think that too. Like, I think that specifically for me, I know personally with this case specifically, because, and I don't want to get specifically in the, all the specifics of his case, because it was a pretty complicated case, but I did this multiple times, because just to have that word where like, okay, yep, we're both thinking the same thing, we're good here. In a complicated case like his, in any case, it's nice to be like, okay, yeah, I did what was right. The other PT thinks the same thing and we're good. Like we can continue on. I think it's just important. I think it's important. I think a lot of times there's egos involved and things like that. Ask. There's no, even if you're, you know, 10 years out and are experienced and everything like that, there's no reason why you wouldn't just say, hey, let's just make sure somebody else thinks the same thing.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, I know we talked a little bit in relation to like the DVT, and like, I think at this point, everyone's heard of the Wells criteria. And I think almost everyone's heard of Virchow's triad. I'm a Grey's Anatomy fanatic, and they even got Virchow's triad correct in the show, right? Like venous stasis, venous injury, hypercoagulability. So outside of like the post-op related DVT or like the long sedentary time related DVT, are there any other mechanisms that you see like occurring for vascular injury or anything else that you see like documented from a research standpoint that might like lead to something like this in an athletic population?
I think the more trauma you have, right? I think my specific patient was kind of a motocross injury, which had additional trauma to it. So anytime you have additional trauma, that's like really heightens your awareness of that. And then honestly, days in hospital, right? So if you have somebody who just, you know, couldn't void or like was in the hospital for a lot longer because of that, that's definitely an indication as well. Other than that, it's kind of the typical risk factors that I found. Nothing like specific that, and I think that's what makes it so hard is a lot of times it's pretty broad. It's like, yeah, okay, of course they had a lower extremity injury. They've been immobilized. But that's also 100 other patients of mine, right? So I think that's what makes it difficult is I wish there was more clear cut boxes on what we're looking for here.
Yeah, no, definitely. Definitely. It's one of those things where it's like, it could always be there. It's not always, well, this happened and now I have to think this, right? Like ACL, it's like, okay, you know, we had a valgus moment. We fell to the ground. We heard a couple pops on the way down. Couldn't stand up afterwards. Knee was immediately swollen. Like that's kind of clear cut. With this, it's a lot of gray and not a whole lot of black and white.
Exactly. And again, that's what makes it so difficult. I think that another thing of note that I saw was it's not generally one thing too. I think it's, and I'm forgetting the reference off the top of my head, but there was a really great article where they discussed, and they kind of had a flow diagram, right? And it was basically in a circle. And it's just like, well, if this could happen, this could happen, and this could happen, and this could happen, right? So I think it's never exactly like, oh, it's just the immobilization, right? I think there's always multiple things, whether it's the genetics, because I know there's a genetic component that we talk about with this a little bit, or anything like that, I think is, there's always something at play. And I think that's, again, what makes it so difficult.
Yeah, no, definitely. And especially in the endurance population as well, because I believe your specific case was in an endurance athlete and the focus was like return to run. You know, I think a lot of times endurance athletes, we get caught up with tracking like mileage or endurance stats. You know, how far did you run that week? How far did you bike that week? But one thing I also like to ask them recently has been, how much walking do you get outside of sport? Because, you know, okay, they go out, they run 8 miles, and then they don't move for the rest of the day. You know, those are kinds of things that I want to know. You mentioned the subjective exam earlier, and it's like those little details might change the way I proceed moving forward.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think any movement is important to discuss the patient, like how often, even job too. I think even if you're working with a college student or a high school kid, like a lot of times they have, you know, jobs that they're walking a lot and you don't think about asking about that, but that's them being active or not active, vice versa. So I think those are things that you should be asking as well and making sure you're covering all your bases there.
Completely agree. And the only other concerning thing I could think of from a mechanism standpoint is really like crush type injuries. You mentioned motocross. I remember one of our past podcast guests actually had it was like a dune buggy four-wheeler type thing out in the mountains that flipped and fell on her leg and crushed her leg. And there was some serious vascular compromise that unfortunately led to an amputation. So it's like, you know, anytime I see those type of injuries too, I think I'm a little bit more guarded. And the other piece you were mentioning on the assessment, we talked about things like dorsalis pedis and that sort of thing, but I think really knowing the anatomy behind this and knowing those regions that we have to be mindful of, like popliteal fossa, for example, you know, a lot of patients, especially after we mentioned ACL earlier, a lot of them have a lot of pain in that back region, right? We have some posterior angulation of bone tunnels. We have a lot of tightness in that area just from the nature of the injury itself, followed by a lot of time in a locked brace, especially if there was like some meniscus repair, prolonged non-weight bearing period as well. So it's like, how do we differentiate that and look into it a little more than just kind of saying like, oh yeah, it's just normal.
Yeah, I think that's what makes it so difficult. I think it's, you know, everybody, especially if you're dealing with like, you know, a multi-ligament knee injury or a meniscal repair, like you said, a lot of times there's very common to have swelling in the calf or have swelling throughout the whole lower extremity, right? So how do you determine what's concerning and what's not? And I think a lot of that comes with experience. So have you seen a lot of ACLs? Have you seen what it's kind of generally supposed to look like, right? And I think a lot of it is also, you've got to lean on the basics. You've got to lean on your neurovascular exam. You've got to lean on all of that. And then I think also educating the patient's really, really important. Like if you have specific pain only in your calf and it's getting worse, it's not getting better, you have numbness and tingling in your toes, I think you really, that's where you have to ask a lot of questions and get really, really specific. Like, where is this pain located? Do you have pain in the knee and the calf? Okay, maybe not as concerning. Do you have, you know, numbness and tingling? Can you wiggle your toes? Like stuff like that, I think is more important in that aspect and asking a lot of questions. And making sure that you're testing things. Like if you're concerned, maybe concerned, like you should note the swelling, like measure the swelling and make sure. And I don't think we do that enough as PTs. I'm talking personally and just in general, what I've seen in clinic, like measure it, right? And if it gets worse, then you, that might be a, okay, now I don't, let's send you somewhere and get this double checked. Cause we do know that, you know, for a lot of these patients, it's not just like one day, right? This normally happens over a gradual amount of time, right? Now, if you're super concerned, you should send them to the doctor regardless. But like if you're like going back and forth and things are just being weird, right? Measure it, ask a lot of questions and do your best. I think, and that's what makes it so hard. That's why it's difficult, is how do you determine it? I wish I had a better answer, and I wish the literature had a better answer too. But from what I could tell, a lot of it is like, let's stick with the basics. And if you're concerned, send them, because it can be life threatening and it can be limb threatening. And that's the last thing you want. You would rather them have to pay an emergency room bill than not have their lower leg the rest of their life. And I think that patients would agree with that as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think they would all agree with that. And that's again, so many amazing points from an overall examination and assessment standpoint. Now, how about, you know, say you find someone who's developed something like a DVT or some type of vascular type of issue, you send them out and then you get them back and it's, you know, cleared to start PT. Where does your head go initially? What do you start with? And what is the next few phases of progression look like following some type of low extremity vascular involvement?
Well, you start with your neurovascular exam. That's for sure.
Again,
I can tell you right now that I have like two specific patients that I'm unfortunately having to deal with this situation with, and they are sick of me touching their foot and looking for pulses and stuff, but you never can be too careful. So you should be testing it and just making sure, right? You'd rather do it 3 or 4 times a session and just be okay with it and not have to worry about it. But yeah, that's the first thing. My patient is always sick because he's like, can I just get on the bike? And I'm like, no, you're going to sit down and I'm going to do this. Like, and we'll take 2 seconds and then you can go get on your bike. But yeah, so that's the first thing you do. And second, I treat it like any other patient, but you have to keep in mind that they're going to probably have calf pain, right? And depending on where they're at, right? So I think that that's something to note, which again, makes it hard for you to figure out if there's a recurrence or not. But I think also you got to educate these patients on what they need to look for. I think that's number one. I talked to my specific patient and luckily he has a history of some emergency medical stuff. He was an EMT for a while, actually. So I was lucky in that he kind of knew what to look for, but we would talk for 20 minutes about what he needs to be looking for. Like, this is not a short conversation with these patients. Take the time and explain everything and answer their questions, because a lot of people have a lot of questions and you have to do it in a way that not, doesn't make people nervous. Right? Because you don't want to make them over thinking about every little itch they have in their calf, right? That's not what we want to do. But you do have to educate, like, hey, these are the things we need to look for before we exercise and after we exercise, like, because I'm not going home with you. Right. And I think that's what makes it so difficult. And then you're doing your normal lower extremity exam, right? You find your impairments, you treat your impairments, and then you go from there. I think also another thing to note in this population that you may not be thinking about quite as often is vitals. You should be monitoring their vitals pretty much throughout, just because that can give you a good sign of what's going on with the vascular system. If they're starting to get lightheaded or dizzy or anything like that, like, you know, this person has had trauma to that system. You got to back it down, and maybe even send them. And just the incidence of like femoral artery as well, those can be a lot more difficult to determine. And a lot of those come with vascular signs right off the bat, vital sign changes. So that's important as well, I think, in this population. And then you get into return to run, and that's where we ran into some issues.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point about vitals, you know, that $20 post pulse ox that's sitting 10 feet away, it takes forever. It's so expensive. It's so easy to assess these things. And to the point that we made earlier, like, you don't even need the pulse ox, right? Like, you learned how to do this in school. Like, take 30 seconds, sharpen the blade of, you know, the clinical skill of literally assessing someone's heart rate, because it comes in handy sometimes.
Also, you know, I think use technology as your friend, right? I'm not saying rely on that heavily, but, like, if they have an Apple Watch, tell them to wear it.
Yeah, use it. And
why, like, not? Like, it's an easy thing to use. You can see it. I mean, I'm not saying don't ever assess it yourself, because I think those watches can be wrong and stuff of that nature, but it's a tool in the toolbox. Use it.
It gives you a good assessment of what they look like when they're not right in front of you too, right? Like,
exactly.
You know, if their resting heart rate has gone up 30 beats per minute over the last week, then it's like, well, why is that? Like, what's going on here? So I certainly think that's an essential point. The other thing I would say is, you know, in my post-op knee population in particular, I rely very heavily on things like BFR cuffs. I also rely very heavily on certain compression type things to help reduce post-op effusion. And I notice a great difference when I use them versus when I don't. However, in these types of populations, I don't really reach right for the BFR cuff the minute that they come back. I don't really reach right for compression the minute they come back. I typically avoid those things until they're cleared by a vascular doc to resume them. And I even ask specific questions like, hey, you know, is there a pressure limit that you want on this? You know, if you're using like compression boot type things, I think everyone's got a set of them in today's day and age. I feel a lot of the little devices allow you to actually adjust the pressures to 10 millimeter increments. So you can, you know, start at lower pressures if you're concerned. You know, for the BFR, I'll just cut them off at a lower intensity. And I just kind of accept that, hey, you know, we might fall behind a little bit from strengthening. The swelling or effusion might stick around a week or two longer, but, you know, I'll make that trade in exchange for me knowing that I'm not going to do, you know, anything relating to, you know, making the situation worse, for lack of a better way to put it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think you should always be communicating with the vascular doctor that they're seeing, because at this point, they're probably, if you're not, if this is, we're talking about somebody who's already had a situation with it, they've seen somebody from vascular. I know for my specific patient that I used the Grand Rounds for, we were not allowed to do any sort of compression. They said no to everything. So we weren't using BFR. I couldn't give them a compression sleeve, which obviously you have to get creative, and think back to, and then you realize, oh, they didn't have BFR forever ago. So, I'm lucky to have that, but yeah, I think you always need to be communicating with your doctors at this point, because again, it's a life threatening thing. It should never just be you. I think a lot of times we feel like we're on an island in PT, even if you're not in the same clinic as the clinician. But I think picking up the phone and calling and being like, listen, I'm treating this patient. What can I do? What are you concerned with? I think is a really, really important point, and you should be communicating with them very regularly about the status of the patient.
I completely agree. And even asking some of the other questions too about, you know, not just like the modality compressive type things, but also like manual compressive type things, mm-hmm. right? Like there's a lot of well-documented research out there. Big shout out to our guy, Phil Plisky, for some of these in, you know, attacking and destroying trigger point type areas and tissue mm-hmm. early on is a really beneficial thing to reduce pain and improve function and strength after surgery, right? We just get things functioning a little bit more, you know, I hate the term optimal, but we'll say optimal. Mm-hmm. But you know, if I'm going to scrape the heck out of someone, I'm really compressing tissue. And you know, if it's me doing it, probably with more force than is necessary. So before I do that, I really want to make sure that there's an understanding of, hey, this is what it's going to be. This is the force behind it. Are we sure? Are we confident? Like double check it, triple check it. Because, you know, if you do something that injures someone, you know, especially with your own hands, like for me personally, I wouldn't sleep at night, right? Like to Never. Me, this is the last place I want someone to get hurt.
Yeah,
you know, if a lot of the kids that come and see us, right, they're injured playing sport. And unfortunately, sports injuries happen regardless of what we do. But I think a lot of the re-injury that we see should not occur in the PT clinic.
I agree 100% with that. I think it's just, it's important to be confident in everything you do with these patients. If you're second guessing something, either ask who you should ask or do the research that you need to do and figure out if this is really, really something that needs to be done. Because the last thing you want, yes, this is their athletic career, but also it's their life too. So making sure that that's priority number one.
You mean to tell me there's more to life than just sports, Mackenzie?
Yeah, that's what they tell me. That's what they tell me.
Craziest thing, my goodness. Now talk me through a little bit on the return to run side for this patient that you were working with. Was there any specific criterion or timeline that you were looking for? And, you know, what did that progression look like? Was it stepwise? Did we start with plyometrics? How do we kind of like progress back to that, you know, running point after all this?
Yeah, so I think it's a loaded question, right? And I think everybody has a different answer to return to run. Like everybody has different criteria. For me personally, I use kind of a criteria done out of the University of Pittsburgh by Rick Jortz and Dr. Erging out of Pitt, which kind of has a good kind of lower extremity. I think that specifically the study they were looking at was ACLs, but that's kind of what I use. Obviously, you want no swelling, pain-free, normal gait pattern. I use 15 minutes of fast walking. If they can't do that, they can't run. Like, and everybody should be able to do 15 minutes of fast walking. I'm not saying it has to be an astronomical pace, right? These speed walkers at the Olympics, we don't need to do that. But a good, solid pace, full range of motion, and then the LSI quad of greater than 80%. Now I go back and forth on that. We have an Ultra G in our clinic. I know not everybody has the luxury of having one of those. So sometimes if they're, you know, 75%, but they hit all the other boxes, I'll put them in the Ultra G. So that's not like a strict cutoff for me. And then perform 10 single leg squats with no compensation, step and holds. And then for him specifically, because of the calf stuff, I did add, because we know he had trauma to that posterior calf, I made him do 20 single leg calf raises, good appropriate, full range. And then I want him to have 5 out of 5, you know, plantar or dorsiflexion, eversion, inversion strength. So that lower leg musculature, just nice and strong. And then I got him running. We use the Delaware protocol. I don't know if
I use the same thing, actually.
It is if people who are listening don't use it, you should look at it because it's super easy to use. You can print out a document and hand it to a patient and they understand what they're supposed to do. It's super, super easy. So I use that every time in the clinic. And that's kind of where I started with him specifically. But I did put him in the Ultra G and we actually ran at 60% body weight. That's because, you know, I don't have any data to back that up, but he had also a posterior hip dislocation as well as a PCL tear too. So we had a lot going on. so I was very conservative with him. And actually, so we started the 0.1 walk run and he did pretty well with that. But then he actually ended up in the emergency room with what the doctors in the emergency room said was a vascular spasm. This was not directly after he ran. This was a few days after, but I don't know if it was related or anything like that. He was neurovascularly intact. And I think this is a good like teaching and learning point with this specific case and why I use this with my specific grand rounds is because things happen in this patient population, right? And I don't think we can control for everything, right? It was a vascular issue. There wasn't anything like I did, he did that, that would have really caused this. I think when you're starting to try to load that vascular system more and you try and it just doesn't work, it doesn't work. Right. I think, that's, you know, and I went back and forth. I was like, oh, should we have ran? He met all my criteria that I would normally use. So if I did it again, I'd do it again. I don't want to put anybody there, but if that's the case, that it happened, right? So if there is a setback with this population, don't freak out. Take a deep breath. It'll be okay. And you move on from there. But I didn't get him running the next day, right? I kind of started down a path because you don't want to put somebody back on the treadmill, him end up in the emergency room, but he needs to be able to run, right? And so I got talking with a lot of my colleagues about it and a lot of different thoughts kind of came out, did a lot of research. Fortunately, there's not a lot of research in this population because you can't really get IRB approval for it probably is the issue. Because when you have somebody who's had issues like this, it's not like we want to like push them and see what the appropriate protocol is. It's just, and it doesn't happen to a lot of people. So I started thinking about like running demands and stuff of that nature. We all know like running is propulsion plus impact, right? You're adding a ton of vertical and horizontal ground reaction force on top of, you know, increased demand on that posterior chain. So for me personally, I started to think about like, what are other ways we can tax him without running? But he was strong, right? I mean, I had tested everything, right? We were happy with where he was at there. And so I started doing like a step-by-step kind of Bruce protocol with him where I was playing a lot more with incline. And that gave me a lot better idea of where he was at and we're still actually doing this. Cause it was relatively recently. He's also, a college kid. So we're all over the place with this. So we started doing a lot of that. But I think you have to figure out different ways to tax it and really test it so that both you and the patient feel comfortable. Cause I can guarantee he doesn't want to run right now.
Yeah.
Cause he associates that with the emergency room, right? Regardless of whether it was or not. And so for me, I started just utilizing kind of some of the tools in my toolbox and trying to figure out if we can tease these situations out. So this isn't necessarily like me plugging like, hey, do a bunch of incline walking with people like this. I think it worked for my patient and it seems to be working. And I think we're going to get him running hopefully next week again and see how it goes. But you know, you got to think outside the box with these patients. It's not going to be, unfortunately, it's not going to be as, you know, cut and dry and beautiful as the Delaware protocol for running. I think there's going to be ups and downs here.
Yeah. And I think you bring up so many amazing points there, Mackenzie. I mean, first off, anytime something just remotely doesn't go according to plan, I think a lot of times we as clinicians really like to look at ourselves in the mirror and blame ourselves for everything because it's all our fault. And then it's like, once you stop and step back and think, it's like, well, you know, they met everything that I wanted them to. They, you know, met all my criteria. They met the timeline. Is it on me? Is it not on me? And I try to frame it in that everything is a learning opportunity. You know, maybe we do return to run day one and they're in a little bit of pain and it doesn't go well. Well, you know, we might have to take a step back, but we just learned so much from that experience. So it can be very difficult, but trying to reframe our mindset around when things don't go according to plan. I also like your point on, you know, even though this is a vascular injury, we still have to meet all the muscular, you know, requirements to initiate return to run. And everyone has different criteria. I get a little greedy with mine. I want 80% quad index. Some people, they're like, hey, 70 is fine, but I really like my 80%. I want the single leg squats. I also really like to look at double leg and single leg plyo before we run, because as you mentioned, you know, running is repeated force through one leg over and over and over again. I mean, a bound is probably the best way I can replicate a running motion. So it's like, if we can't do a few bounds without issue or compensation, running probably is not going to go too smooth for us. So really having your progressions dialed in. And as you mentioned, you know, progressions are, they can be loaded. There's not really one right or wrong way to do it. It's just whatever you feel makes the most sense for the people you're working with, makes the most sense from a research standpoint, and also continues to produce the results and outcomes that you want. You know, if you're letting people run at 70% quad index and then they all come back with knee pain and, you know, difficulty and deficits, maybe we need to up that number a little bit. Maybe we need to get just a little more greedy and push the quad strength a little bit more. Maybe they could run at 70% without issue. But if they can run at 70 and feel good, they're probably going to feel even better at 80. And then also to your point as well, like, you know, from a progression standpoint, we're thinking in terms of vasculature as our limiting factor, hopefully not the strength at this point. So if vasculature is our limiting factor, we do have to understand how different things will stress that system, but also how it will change the muscular demands that we see and how that changes what we see from a vascular response as well, right? Like, you know, I don't know all of the EMG analysis of incline versus flat level versus decline walking or running or that sort of thing, but I can assume that, you know, walking up at a 20% incline is going to feel a lot different than walking down at a 20% decline. So, you know, if this is something that we need to dive into the weeds for the patient we're working with and actually understand some of those deeper EMG analysis type things, like, hey, you know, maybe we had something in the calf, maybe we're concerned about calf, you know, vasculature that way. Is there any way that I could, you know, still get a walking aerobic type stimulus, or even, you know, think outside of the box and get an aerobic stimulus, endurance stimulus, not walking or not running, but still tax that system, but not load that specific area as much. As you mentioned, it's loaded in the sense that there's not one right or wrong way to do it. I think there's, you know, 1,000 different ways to progress this. It's just a matter of what makes the most sense for the person in front of you at the given time.
And also what's the patient comfortable with too. I think with my specific patient, there's also a lot of mental stuff going on there as well. And so I think, again, this is where, you know, you need to talk to the patient. You need to communicate like what you're trying to do and understand that like, we're still progressing here. We're just, we're doing it at a slower pace and we're trying to figure out how we can get this system. I think it's also important because we are dealing with the vascular system to just mention there's going to be a timing component to this too. I think because you're going to have to wait for that vascular system to heal. Right. And so at a certain point, we might hit a point where musculoskeletally, we are doing pretty well, and we don't maybe find any impairments that we can see, but the vascular system's just not there yet. And that's where we need to refer back to those docs. I know for my patient specifically, after this whole incident happened, I was in quite a lot of communication with the doctor about this, because doctors like, do you think he's gonna? We had a conversation. Do we think we're gonna get him back to running? We might just need time to heal at this point. Right. So I think there's also that component of it too. We have to keep in mind that the vascular system doesn't always heal like the musculoskeletal system, like we're used to. Right. So I think also understanding that aspect of it too, is important. And that's why we have great colleagues to talk to about that and try to figure out what's the best to continue to progress to.
Sometimes it's loaded that we call it physical therapy, because to your point, sometimes those mental apprehensions and barriers after these type of injuries are more of an obstacle to us than the physical limitations. So much so that I think, you know, a lot of times we just get so caught up in the fact that, like, you know, we're the clinician, you know, we're supposed to know things, yada, yada, yada. But we kind of forget, like, hey, you know, that athlete we're working with, they've been on a sport for a long time. Their identity is probably in sport, especially if they're at the high, you know, college level or professional level. So they might have some apprehension about that. It's normal to feel a little bit concerned about the return, especially when you have some of those, you know, unexpected twists pop up. Like, people are going to get worried about it. People are going to get apprehensive. And I think that finding ways to shift the locus of control back to them is absolutely essential during those times of uncertainty and really progressing within their comfort. Like, yes, we have to push them, but we also don't need to go from, you know, couch to 5K overnight, so to speak. Yeah. So I love that point. And I love your point too on vascular healing. And I think that's a whole topic that you could get in the weeds to as well. All the different things that impact vascular healing, inflammatory processes, and so on that way. Like, there's so much to it. But as we mentioned earlier, sometimes just going for the low hanging fruit and doing the simple things really well makes all the difference, right? Like, you might not have to go out and research the best anti-inflammatory diet to help, you know, improve vascular healing or sign up for thousands of dollars of different like modality sessions that may or may not actually do anything. I think a lot of times the simple things done well and a good timeline-based progression back can really solve a lot of issues.
I think there's definitely a timing component with these patients too, and understanding that, you know, the 9-month cutoff with ACL and kind of those general things, depending on their surgery, it's not going to look like your normal ACL. There's going to be delayed timing here. And communicating that with the patient early on is important too. Like, hey, we had this situation. We're going to take our time. We're going to get it right, but it's going to take a bit longer.
Outside of just progression back through the running and getting them back to, like, say, you know, 2 to 3 miles consistently, do you have any concern from a vascular standpoint once you get to more, say, like interval based or conditioning type things? How does your concern change when we go from more like steady state progression to more interval or high intensity type work?
Well, I think absolutely it changes. I think, you know, I haven't gotten there with the specific patient I was looking at with this stuff, but I think just looking at the literature and everything like that, like, there can be a setback at any point, right? So you need to stay on top of it for a while, right? And that goes back to the things we were talking about with vitals and making sure that things like that are staying stable while they're running. I like to think of it like a concussion, right? Like, there's a cardiovascular component to a concussion most of the time, right? And I know we're kind of talking about two separate things, but you should be looking at the cardiovascular system as well as you're progressing these things, because that can absolutely be impacted in these patients. So making sure, like, obviously if we're getting them running for 2 to 3 miles for the first time in, you know, 9 months, it's going to be cardiovascularly taxing, but does it look like it's supposed to look like for a patient of this? You know, if their heart rate is ridiculously high, that's concerning for, you know, probably a young kid, 18-year-old kid who just, you know, had an ACL situation, right? So I think keeping on track of those things, and I think also understanding that they should be running for the first time with those kind of things with you. I think a lot of times, and it's hard because insurance drives a lot of our care, right? And so I think a lot of times we are like, yeah, you can run on your own. We cleared it in clinic, right? But I think consistently this patient should be running with you for a while and making sure that we're checking all those boxes for a bit before we let them kind of go off on their own and do like a 2-3 mile jog by themselves.
Yeah, no, definitely. And even when they do get to that point, I usually ask them to run with a friend or just have someone with them just in case. Yep. You know, we could be 99.9% sure that everything is going to go smooth. What about that 0.1%? And I would just rather have someone there just in case.
Absolutely.
I also really like the text message follow-up afterwards. Like, hey, how did that go? Or maybe the next day I'm just like, hey, how are you feeling? I, you know, just as we talked about communication with other clinicians, patient communication outside of the clinic is also essential. And
I think, you know, over-communicating with
patients 100%.
Is important. Yeah.
That solves so many issues and so many things. I mean, I feel like we could just be giving relationship advice right now. Like,
exactly.
But I feel like
nobody wants a patient that walks in and had a bunch of issues and then they're in the clinic and they really should be in the emergency room.
Yeah.
Like, that's Like, that's not what you want to start your Monday with.
No.
Like, you would rather be able to have them text you and be like, yep, this happened. And you can be like, yep, go right to the emergency room, have somebody drive you. Like, it eliminates a lot of the waiting around and that stuff too. So if something happens, it's also important, but hopefully nothing happens. You know?
Completely agree. Mackenzie, I feel like we've covered a lot of ground as it relates to vascular injury and athletes today. And we could probably talk about this until we're both blue in the face.
Probably.
Do you have any kind of closing thoughts or closing remarks or anything we might have missed that way?
I don't think we missed anything. I think just reiterating, it's important to communicate both with your colleagues, ask for second opinions, and with your patients, whether that's patient education or as you're continuing to progress to get these patients right. I think that's where a lot of this is, and just communicating that these are complicated. This is complicated stuff, right? We don't normally see this. These are one in, you know, I don't have a specific statistic for you, but these don't happen very often. But when they do, we need to make sure we're approaching it the right way. And just take a pause if you need to. Do your research, talk to people in the field and see what their thoughts are and progress the best way you know how.
Yeah. Exactly. And as you mentioned, there's no shame in asking other people for help. Even I'm known to occasionally send the email or text message or sometimes even the DM to someone that I know who's working or has experience in this population and just ask questions. Like, you know, at the end of the day, in our pursuit of mastery, we have to realize we don't know everything currently. We're Absolutely. Never going to know everything currently, and it never hurts to get that other, you know, input and experience that way. So, you know, for people who might want to find out more about you or stay in touch with you or kind of find you online that way, Mackenzie, where can they find you at?
Absolutely. My email is always open. It's my last name, mk@upmc.edu. So feel free to reach out to me there. I also have an Instagram. It's just Ken's_Yab. Happy to talk to anybody who would be interested in talking about this or anything else. I know a lot of people reach out to me about residency and stuff of that nature too. So feel free to reach out for anything and I'll see if I can help in any way.
But, yeah, for sure. We'll link to all of that in the description below too. That way, if you didn't quite catch it, you can just click there. Mackenzie, I really appreciate your time and everything you're doing. Thank you so much.
I appreciate you having me. Thank you.